I am the blood of the dragon, she thought. If they are monstrous, so am I.
Reek. The rat squealed as he bit into it, squirming wild in his hands, frantic to escape. The belly was the softest part. He tore at the sweet meat, the warm blood running over his lips. It was so good that it brought tears to his eyes. His belly rumbled, and he swallowed. By the third bite the rat had ceased the struggle, and he was feeling almost content. Then he heard the sounds of voices outside the dungeon door. At once he stilled, fearing even to chew. His mouth was full of blood and flesh and hair, but he dare not spit or swallow. He listened in terror, stiff as stone, to the scuff of boots and the clanking of iron keys.
No, he thought. No, please, gods, not now, not now. It had taken him so long to catch the rat. If they catch me with it, they will take it away, and then they'll tell, and Lord Ramsay will hurt me.
He knew he ought to hide the rat, but he was so hungry. It had been 2 days since he had eaten, or maybe 3. Down here in the dark it was hard to tell. Though his arms and legs were thin as reeds, his belly was swollen and hollow, and ached so much that he found he could not sleep. Whenever he closed his eyes, he found himself remembering Lady Hornwood. After their wedding, Lord Ramsay had locked her away in a tower and starved her to death. In the end, she had eaten her own fingers. He crouched down in a corner of his cell, clutching his prize under his chin. Blood ran from the corners of his mouth as he nibbled at the rat with what remained of his teeth, trying to bolt down as much of the warm flesh as he could before the cell was opened. The meat was stringy, but so rich he thought he might be sick. He chewed and swallowed, picking small bones from the holes in his gums where teeth had been yanked out. It hurt to chew, but he was so hungry he could not stop. The sounds were growing louder.
"Please, gods, he isn't coming for me," he prayed, tearing off one of the rat's legs.
It had been a long time since anyone had come for him. There were other cells, other prisoners. Sometimes he heard them screaming, even through the thick stone walls. The women always screamed the loudest. He sucked at the raw meat and tried to spit out the leg bone, but it only dribbled over his lower lip and tangled in his beard.
"Go away," he prayed. "Go away. Pass me by, please, please."
But the footsteps stopped just when they were loudest, and the keys clattered right outside the door. The rat fell from his fingers. He wiped his bloody fingers on his breeches.
"No," he mumbled. "No."
His heels scrabbled at the straw as he tried to push himself into the corner, into the cold, damp stone walls. The sound of the lock turning was the most terrible of all. When the light hit him full in the face, he let out a shriek. He had to cover his eyes with his hands. He would have clawed them out if he dared. His head was pounding so.
"Take it away. Do it in the dark. Please, oh, please." "That's not him," said a boy's voice. "Look at him. We've got the wrong cell." "Last cell on the left," another boy replied. "This is the last cell on the left, isn't it?"
"Aye." A pause.
"What's he saying?" "I don't think he likes the light."
"Would you, if you look like that?" The boy hawked and spat.
"And the stench of him. Oh, I'm like to choke." "He's been eating rats," said the second boy. "Look."
The first boy laughed.
"He has. That's funny." "I had to.
The rats bit him when he slept, gnawing at his fingers and his toes, even at his face. So when he got his hands on one, he did not hesitate. Eat or be eaten. Those were the only choices.
"I did it," he mumbled. I did. I ate him. They do the same to me. Please."
The boys moved closer, the straw crunching softly under their feet.
"Talk to me," said one of them.
He was the smaller of the two, a thin boy, but clever.
"Do you remember who you are?"
The fear came bubbling up inside him, and he moaned.
"Talk to me. Tell me your name." "My name," a scream caught in his throat.
They had taught him his name. They had. Oh, they had. but had been so long that he'd forgotten.
If I say it wrong, he'd take another finger. Or worse,
He would not think about that. He could not think about that. There were needles in his jaw, in his eyes. His head was pounding.
Please,
he squeaked, his voice thin and weak. He sounded 100 years old. Perhaps he was.
How long have I been in here?
Go, he mumbled through broken teeth and broken fingers, his eyes closed tight against the terrible bright light.
Please, you can have the rat. Don't hurt me.
Reek, said the larger of the boys.
Your name is Reek, remember?
He was the one with the torch. The smaller boy had the ring of iron keys.
Reek, tears ran down his cheeks. I remember. I do.
His mouth opened and closed.
My name is Reek. It rhymes with leek.
In the dark he did not need a name, so it was easy to forget.
Reek, Reek, my name is Reek.
He had not been born with that name. In another life he had been someone else. But here and now his name was Reek. He remembered. He remembered the boys as well. They were clad in matching lambswool doublets, silver-grey with dark blue trim. Both were squires, both were 8, and both were Walder Frey.
Big Walter and Little Walter, yes.
Only the big one was little and the little one was big, which amused the boys and confused the rest of the world.
I know you, he whispered through cracked lips. I know your names. You're to come with us, said Little Walder. His lordship has need of you, said Big Walder.
Fear went through him like a knife.
They're only children, he thought. 2 boys of 8.
He could overcome 2 boys of 8, surely, even as weak as he was. He could take the torch, take the keys, take the dagger sheathed on Little Walder's hip. Escape.
No, no, it's too easy. It is a trap if I run. He will take another finger from me. He will take more of my teeth.
He had run before. Years ago, it seemed, when he still had some strength in him, when he had still been defiant. That time it had been Cairo with the keys. She told him she had stolen them, that she knew a postern gate that was never guarded.
"Take me back to Winterfell, my lord," she begged,
pale-faced and trembling.
"I don't know the way. I can't escape alone. Come with me, please."
And so he had. The jailer was dead drunk in a puddle of wine, with his breeches down around his ankles. The dungeon door was open, and the postern gate had been unguarded, just as she had said. They waited for the moon to go behind a cloud, then slipped from the castle and splashed across the weeping water, stumbling over stones half frozen by the icy stream. On the far side, he had kissed her.
"You've saved us," he said. "Fool, fool."
It had all been a trap, a game, a jape. Lord Ramsay loved the chase and preferred to hunt 2-legged prey. All night they ran through the darkling wood. But as the sun came up, the sound of a distant horn came faintly through the trees, and they heard the baying of a pack of hounds.
"We should split up," he told Kyra,
as the dogs grew closer. "They cannot track us both." The girl was crazed with fear, though, and refused to leave his side, even when he swore he would raise a host of ironborn and come back for her if she should be the one they followed. Within the hour, they were taken. One dog knocked him to the ground, and a second bit Kara on the leg as she scrambled up a hillside. The rest surrounded them, baying and snarling, snapping at them every time they moved, holding them there until Ramsay Snow rode up with his huntsman. He was still a bastard then, not yet a Bolton. "There you are," he said, smiling down at them from the saddle. "You wound me, wandering off like this. Have you grown tired of my hospitality so soon?" That was when Kyra seized a stone and threw it at his head. It missed by a good foot, and Ramsay smiled. "Oh, you must be punished." Reek remembered the desperate, frightened look in Kyra's eyes. She had never looked so young as she did in that moment, still half a girl, but there was nothing he could do.
"She brought them down on us," he thought. if we had separated as I wanted, one of us might have gotten away.
The memory made it hard to breathe. Reek turned away from the torch, with tears glimmering in his eyes.
What does he want to me this time? He thought, despairing. Why won't he just leave me be? I did no wrong. Not this time. Why won't they just leave me in the dark?
He'd had a rat, a fat one, warm and wriggling.
Should we wash him?
Asked Little Walder.
His lordship likes him stinky, said Big Walder. That's why he named him Reek. Reek, my name is Reek. It rhymes with bleak.
He had to remember that.
Serve and obey, and remember who you are, and no more harm will come to you. He promised. His lordship promised.
Even if he'd wanted to resist, he did not have the strength. It had been scourged from him, starved from him, flayed from him. When Little Walder pulled him up, and Big Walder waved the torch at him to herd him from the cell, he went along as docile as a dog. If he'd had a tail, he would have tucked it down between his legs.
If I had a tail, the bastard would have cut it off.
The thought came unbidden, a vile thought, dangerous. His lordship was not a bastard any more.
Bolton, not Snow.
The boy king on the Iron Throne had made Lord Ramsay legitimate, giving him the right to use his lord father's name. Calling him Snow reminded him of his bastardy, and sent him into a black rage. Reek must remember that. And his name. He must remember his name. For half a heartbeat had eluded him, and that frightened him so badly that he tripped on the steep dungeon steps and tore his breeches open on the stone, drawing blood. Little Walder had to shove the torch at him to get him back on his feet and moving again. Out in the yard, night was settling over the Dreadfort, and a full moon was rising over the castle's eastern walls. Its pale light cast the shadows of the tall, triangular merlons across the frozen ground, a line of sharp black teeth. The air was cold and damp, and full of half-forgotten smells.
The world, Reek told himself. This is what the world smells like.
He did not know how long he had been down there in the dungeons, but it had to have been half a year at least.
That long or longer? What if it has been 5 years, or 10, or 20? Would I even know? What if I went mad down there, and half my life is gone?
But no, that was folly. It could not have been so long. The boys were still boys. If it had been 10 years, they would have grown into men. He had to remember that.
I must not let them drive me mad. He can take my fingers and my toes. He can put out my eyes and slice my ears off. But he cannot take my wits unless I let him.
Little Walder led the way with torch in hand. Reek followed meekly, with Big Walder just behind him. The dogs in the kennels barked as they went by. Wind swirled through the yard, cutting through the thin cloth of the filthy rags he wore and raising goose prickles on his skin. The night air was cold and damp, but he saw no sign of snow, though surely winter was close at hand. Reek wondered if he would be alive to see the snows come.
How many fingers will I have? How many toes?
When he raised a hand, he was shocked to see how white it was, how fleshless.
Skin and bones, he thought. I have an old man's hands.
Could he have been wrong about the boys? What if they were not Little Walder and Big Walder after all, but the sons of the boys he'd known? The great hall was dim and smoky. Rows of torches burned to left and right, grasped by skeletal human hands jutting from the walls. High overhead were wooden rafters black from smoke, and a vaulted ceiling lost in shadow. The air was heavy with the smells of wine and ale and roasted meat. Reek's stomach rumbled noisily at the scents, and his mouth began to water. Little Walder pushed him stumbling past the long tables where the men of the garrison were eating. He could feel their eyes upon him. The best places, up near the dais, were occupied by Ramsay's favourites, the bastard's boys. Ben Bones, the old man who kept his lordship's beloved hunting hounds. Damon, called Damon Dance for me, fair-haired and boyish. Grunt, who had lost his tongue for speaking carelessly in Lord Roos's hearing. Sir Allen, Skinner, Yellow Dick. Further down below the salt were others that Reek knew by sight, if not by name. Sworn swords and sergeants, soldiers and jailers and torturers. But there were strangers, too. Faces he did not know. Some wrinkled their noses as he passed, whilst others laughed at the sight of him.
"Guess," Reek thought, "his lordship's friends, and I am brought up to amuse them."
A shiver of fear went through him. At the high table, the bastard of Bolton sat in his lord father's seat, drinking from his father's cup. Two old men shared the high table with him, and Reek knew at a glance that both were lords. One was gaunt, with flinty eyes, a long white beard, and his face as hard as a winter frost. His jerkin was a ragged bearskin, worn and greasy. Underneath he wore a ringmail burnie, even at table. The second lord was thin as well, but twisted where the first was straight. One of his shoulders was much higher than the other, and he stooped over his trencher like a vulture over carrion. His eyes were grey and greedy, his teeth yellow, his forked beard a tangle of snow and silver. Only a few wisps of white hair still clung to his spotted skull. But the cloak he wore was soft and fine, grey wool trimmed with black sable and fastened at the shoulder with a starburst wrought in beaten silver. Ramsay was clad in black and pink, black boots, black belt and scabbard, black leather jerkin over a pink velvet doublet, slashed with dark red satin. In his right ear gleamed a garnet, cut in the shape of a drop of blood. Yet for all the splendour of his garb, he remained an ugly man, big bone and slope-shouldered, with a fleshiness to him that suggested that in later life he would run to vet. His skin was pink and blotchy, his nose broad, his mouth small, his hair long and dark and dry. His lips were wide and meaty, but the thing men noticed first about him were his eyes. He had his lord father's eyes, small, close-set, queerly pale. Ghost-grey, some men called the shade. But in truth his eyes were all but colourless, like two chips of dirty ice. At the sight of Reek, he smiled a wet-lipped smile. "There he is, my sore old friend." To the men beside him he said, "Reek has been with me since I was a boy. My lord father gave him to me as a token of his love." The two lords exchanged a look.
"I had heard your servant man was dead," said the one with the stooped shoulder. "Slain by the Starks," they said.
Lord Ramsay chuckled. "The Iron Man will tell you that what is dead may never die, but rises again harder and stronger, like Reek. He smells of the grave, though, I grant you that."
"He smells of night soil and stale vomit."
The stoop-shouldered old lord tossed aside the bone that he'd been gnawing on and wiped his fingers on the tablecloth.
"Is there some reason you must needs inflict him upon us whilst we're eating?"
The second lord, the straight-backed old man in the male burnie, studied Reek with flinty eyes. "Look again," he urged the other lord. "His hair's gone white, and he's 3 stone thinner, aye, but this is no serving man. Have you forgotten?" The crookback lord looked again and gave a sudden snort.
"Him? Can it be? Stark's ward? Smiling? Always smiling?"
"He smiles less often now," Lord Ramsay confessed. "I may have broken some of his pretty white teeth." "You would have done better to slit his throat," said the lord in mail. "A dog who turns against his master is fit for nought but skinning." "Oh, he's been skinned here and there," said Ramsay.
"Yes, my lord, I was bad, my lord. Insolent and,
He licked his lip, trying to think of what else he had done.
"Serve and obey," he told himself, "and he'll let you live, and keep the parts that you still have. serve and obey, and remember your name. Reek, reek, it rhymes with meek. Bad and...
There's blood on your mouth, Ramsay observed. Have you been chewing on your fingers again, Reek?
No, no, my lord, I swear.
Reek had tried to bite his own ring finger off once, to stop it hurting, after they had stripped the skin from it. Lord Ramsay would never simply cut off a man's finger. He preferred to flay it, and let the exposed flesh dry and crack and fester. Reek had been whipped and racked and cut, but there was no pain half so excruciating as the pain that followed flaying. It was the sort of pain that drove men mad, and it could not be endured for long. Soon or late, the victim would scream, "Please, no more, no more! Stop it hurting! Cut it off!" And Lord Ramsay would oblige. It was a game they played. Reek had learned the rules, as his hand and feet could testify. But that one time he had forgotten, and tried to end the pain himself, with his teeth. Ramsay had not been pleased, and the offence had cost Reek another toe.
"I ate a rat," he mumbled.
"A rat?" Ramsay's pale eyes glittered in the torchlight. "All the rats in the Dreadfort belong to my lord father. How dare you make a meal of one without my leave?" Reek did not know what to say, so he said nothing. One wrong word could cost him another toe, even a finger. Thus far he had lost two fingers off his left hand and the pinky off his right, but only the little toe off his right foot against three from his left. Sometimes Ramsay would make japes about balancing him out.
"My lord was only japing," he tried to tell himself. "He does not want to hurt me. He told me so. He only does it when I give him cause."
His lord was merciful and kind. He might have flayed his face off for some of the things Reek had said, before he'd learned his true name and proper place. "This grows tedious," said the lord in the male burney. "Kill him and be done with it." Lord Ramsay filled his cup with ale.
"That will spoil our celebration, my lord. Reek, I have glad tidings for you. I am to be wed. My lord father is bringing me a Stark girl, Lord Eddard's daughter, Arya. You remember little Arya, don't you?"
"Arya Underfoot," he almost said. "Arya Horseface,
Rob's younger sister, brown-haired, long-faced, skin is a stick, always dirty."
"Sansa was a pretty one."
He remembered a time when he had thought that Lord Eddard Stark might marry him to Sansa and claim him for a son. But that had only been a child's fancy. "Arya, though,
I remember her, Arya.
She shall be the Lady of Winterfell, and me her lord. She is only a girl."
"Yes, my lord, congratulations."
"Will you attend me at my wedding, Reek?" He hesitated.
"If you wish it, my lord."
"Oh, I do." He hesitated again, wondering if this was some cruel trap.
"Yes, my lord, if it please you, I would be honored."
"We must take you out of that vile dungeon, then. Scrub you pink again. Get you some clean clothes, some food to eat, some nice soft porridge. Would you like that? Perhaps a peas pie laced with bacon? I have a little task for you, and you'll need your strength back if you are to serve me." "You do want to serve me, I know."
"Yes, my lord, more than anything."
A shiver went through him.
"I'm your Reek. Please let me serve you. Please."
"Since you ask so nicely, how can I deny you?" Ramsay Bolton smiled. "I ride to war, Reek, and you will be coming with me to help me fetch home my virgin bride." Bran. Something about the way the raven screamed sent a shiver running up Bran's spine.
"I'm almost a man grown," he had to remind himself. "I have to be brave now."
But the air was sharp and cold and full of fear. Even summer was afraid. The fur on his neck was bristling. Shadows stretched against the hillside, black and hungry. All the trees were bowed and twisted by the weight of ice they carried. Some hardly looked like trees at all, buried from root to crown in frozen snow. They huddled on the hill like giants, monstrous and misshapen creatures hunched against the icy wind. "They are here," the ranger drew his longsword.
"Where?"
Mira's voice was hushed. "Close. I don't know. Somewhere." The raven shrieked again.
"Hodor,"
whispered Hodor. He had his hands tucked up beneath his armpits. Icicles hung from the brown briar of his beard, and his moustache was a lump of frozen snot, glittering redly in the light of sunset.
"Those wolves are close as well," Bran warned them. "The ones that have been following us. Summer can smell them whenever we're downwind."
"Wolves are the least of our woes," said Cold Hands. "We have to climb. It will be dark soon. You would do well to be inside before night comes. Your warmth will draw them."
He glanced to the west, where the light of the setting sun could be seen dimly through the trees like the glow of a distant fire.
"Is this the only way in?" asked Mira.
"The back door is 3 leagues north, down a sinkhole."
That was all he had to say. Not even Hodor could climb down into a sinkhole with Bran heavy on his back, and Jojen could no more walk 3 leagues than run 1,000. Mira eyed the hill above.
"The way looks clear."
"Looks," the ranger muttered darkly. "Can you feel the cold? There's something here. Where are they?"
"Inside the cave," suggested Mira.
"The cave is warded. They cannot pass." The ranger used his sword to point. "You can see the entrance there, halfway up, between the weirwoods, that cleft in the rock."
"I see it," said Bran.
Ravens were flying in and out. Hodor shifted his weight.
"Hodor!"
"A fold in the rock, that's all I can see," said Mira.
"There's a passage there, steep and twisty at first. A runnel through the rock. If you can reach it, you'll be safe."
"What about you?"
"The cave is warded."
Mira studied the cliff and the hillside.
"It can't be more than 1,000 yards from here to there."
"No," thought Bran.
"But all those yards are upward."
The hill was steep and thickly wooded. The snow had stopped 3 days ago, but none of it had melted. Beneath the trees the ground was blanketed in white, still pristine and unbroken.
"No one's here," said Bran bravely. "Look at the snow. There are no footprints."
"The White Walkers go lightly on the snow," the ranger said. "You'll find no prints to mark their passage."
A raven descended from above to settle on his shoulder. Only 12 of the big black birds remained with them. The rest had vanished along the way. Every dawn when they arose, there had been fewer of them.
"Come,"
the bird squawked.
"Come, come."
"The three-eyed crow," thought Bran. "The green's here."
"It's not so far," he said. "A little climb, and we'll be safe. Maybe we can have a fire."
All of them were cold and wet and hungry, except the ranger, and Jojen Reed was too weak to walk unaided.
"You go,"
Mira Reed bent down beside her brother. He was settled in the bole of an oak, eyes closed, shivering violently. What little of his face could be seen beneath his hood and scarf was as colourless as the surrounding snow, but breath still puffed faintly from his nostrils whenever he exhaled. Mare had been carrying him all day. "Food and fire will set him right again," Bran tried to tell himself, though he wasn't sure it would.
"I can't fight and carry Jojen both. The climb's too steep," Mira was saying. "Hodor, you take Bran up to that cave."
"Hodor!"
Hodor clapped his hands together.
"Jojen just needs to eat," Bran said miserably.
It had been 12 days since the elk had collapsed for the third and final time, since Cold Hands had knelt beside it in the snowbank and murmured a blessing in some strange tongue as he slit its throat. Bran wept like a little girl when the bright blood came rushing out. He had never felt more like a cripple than he did then, watching helplessly as Mira, Reed, and Cold Hands butchered the brave beast who had carried them so far. He told himself he would not eat, that it was better to go hungry than to feast upon a friend. But in the end he'd eaten twice, once in his own skin and once in Summer's. As gaunt and starved as the elk had been, the steaks the ranger carved from him had sustained them for 7 days, until they finished the last of them huddled over a fire in ruins of an old hill fort.
"He needs to eat," Mira agreed, smoothing her brother's brow. "We all do, but there's no food here. Go!"
Bran blinked back a tear and felt it freeze upon his cheek. Cold Hands took Hodor by the arm.
"The light is fading. If they're not here now, they will be soon. Come!"
Wordless for once, Hodor slapped the snow off his legs and ploughed upward through the snowdrifts with Bran upon his back. Cold Hands stalked beside them, his blade in a black hand. Summer came after. In some places the snow was higher than he was, and the big direwolf had to stop and shake it off after plunging through the thin crust. As they climbed, Bran turned awkwardly in his basket to watch as Mira slid an arm beneath her brother to lift him to his feet.
"He's too heavy for her. She's half-starved. She's not as strong as she was."
She clutched her frog spear in her other hand, jabbing the tines into the snow for a little more support. Mira had just begun to struggle up the hill, half-dragging and half-carrying a little brother, when Hodor passed between two trees, and Bran lost sight of them. The hill grew steeper. Drifts of snow cracked under Hodor's boots. Once a rock moved beneath his foot, and he slid backwards and almost went tumbling back down the hill. The ranger caught him by the arm and saved him.
"Hodor," said Hodor.
Every gust of wind filled the air with fine white powder that shone like glass in the last light of day. Ravens flapped around them. One flew ahead and vanished inside the cave.
"Only 80 yards now," Bran thought. "That's not far at all."
Summer stopped suddenly at the bottom of the steep stretch of unbroken white snow. The direwolf turned his head, sniffed the air, then snarled. Fur bristling, he began to back away.
"Hodor, stop," said Bran. "Hodor, wait!"
Something was wrong. Summer smelled it, and so did he.
"Something bad, something close. Hodor, no, go back!"
Cold Hands was still climbing, and Hodor wanted to keep up.
"Hodor, Hodor, Hodor,"
he grumbled loudly to drown out Bran's complaints. His breathing had grown labored. Pale mist filled the air. He took a step, then another. The snow was almost waist-deep, and the slope was very steep. Hodor was leaning forward, grasping at rocks and trees with his hands as he climbed. Another step, another. The snow Hodor disturbed slid downhill, starting a small avalanche behind them.
60 yards.
Bran craned himself sideways to better see the cave. Then he saw something else.
A fire!
In the little cleft between the weirwood trees was a flickering glow, a ruddy light calling through the gathering gloom.
"Look, someone!" Hodor screamed. He twisted, stumbled, fell.
Bran felt the world slide sideways as the big stable boy spun violently around. A jarring impact drove the breath from him. His mouth was full of blood, and Hodor was thrashing and rolling, crushing the crippled boy beneath him.
"Something has hold of his leg."
For half a heartbeat, Bran thought maybe a root had gotten tangled around his ankle, until the root moved. A hand, he saw, as the rest of the white came bursting from beneath the snow. Hodor kicked at it, slamming a snow-covered heel full into the thing's face. But the dead man did not even seem to feel it. Then the two of them were grappling, punching, and clawing at each other, sliding down the hill. Snow filled Bran's mouth and nose as they rolled over, but in half a heartbeat he was rolling up again. Something slammed against his head, a rock or a chunk of ice or a dead man's fist, he could not tell, and he found himself out of his basket, sprawled across the hillside, spitting snow, his gloved hand full of hair that he'd torn from Hodor's head. All around him, whites were rising from beneath the snow. 2, 3, 4, Bran lost count. They surged up violently, amidst sudden clouds of snow. Some wore black cloaks, some ragged skins, some nothing. All of them had pale flesh and black hands. Their eyes glowed like pale blue stars. 3 of them descended on the ranger. Bran saw Cold Hands slash one across the face. The thing kept right on coming, driving him back into the arms of another. 2 more were going after Hodor, lumbering clumsily down the slope. Mira was going to climb right into this, Bran realized with a sick sense of helpless terror. He smashed the snow and shouted out a warning. Something grabbed hold of him. That was when his shout became a scream. Bran filled a fist with snow and threw it, but the white did not so much as blink. A black hand fumbled at his face, another at his belly. Its fingers felt like iron. "He's going to pull my guts out." But suddenly, summer was between them. Bran glimpsed skin tear like cheap cloth, heard the splintering of bone. He saw a hand and wrist ripped loose, pale fingers wriggling, the sleeve, faded black rough spun. "Black," he thought. "He's wearing black. He was one of the watch." Summer flung the arm aside, twisted, and sank his teeth into the dead man's neck, under the chin. When the big grey wolf wrenched free, he took most of the creature's throat out in an explosion of pale, rotten meat. The severed hand was still moving. Bran rolled away from it. On his belly, clawing at the snow, he glimpsed the trees above, pale and snow-cloaked, the orange glow between. 50 yards! If he could drag himself 50 yards, they could not get him. Damp seeped through his gloves as he clutched at roots and rocks, crawling toward the light.
"A little farther, just a little farther, and you can rest beside the fire."
The last light had vanished from amongst the trees by then. Night had fallen. Cold Hands was hacking and cutting at the circle of dead men that surrounded him. Summer was tearing at the one that he'd brought down, its face between his teeth. No one was paying any mind to Bran. He crawled a little higher, dragging his useless legs behind him.
"If I can reach that cave..." "Hodor!"
came a whimper from somewhere down below. And suddenly he was not Bran, the broken boy, crawling through the snow. Suddenly he was Hodor, halfway down the hill, with a white raking at his eyes. Roaring, he came lurching to his feet, throwing the thing violently aside. It went to one knee, began to rise again. Bran ripped Hodor's long sword from his belt. Deep inside, he could hear poor Hodor whimpering still. But outside, he was 7 feet of fury, with old iron in his hand. He raised the sword and brought it down upon the dead man, grunting as the blade sheared through wet wool and rusted mail and rutted leather, biting deep into the bones and flesh beneath. "Hodor!" he bellowed, and slashed again. This time he took the white's head off at the neck, and for half a moment he exulted, until a pair of dead hands came groping blindly for his throat. Bran backed away, bleeding, and Mira Reed was there, driving her frog spear deep into the white's back. "Hodor!" Bran roared again, waving her uphill. "Hodor! Hodor!" Jojen was twisting feebly where she laid him down. Bran went to him, dropped the longsword, gathered the boy into Hodor's arm, and lurched back to his feet. "Hodor!" he bellowed. Mira led the way back up the hill, jabbing at the whites when they came near. The things could not be hurt, but they were slow and clumsy. "Hodor!" Hodor said with every step. "Hodor! Hodor!" He wondered what Mira would think if he should suddenly tell her that he loved her. Up above them, flaming figures were dancing in the snow. "The whites," Bran realized. Someone set the whites on fire. Summer was snarling and snapping as he danced around the closest. A great ruin of a man wreathed in swirling flame. He shouldn't get so close. What's he doing? Then he saw himself, sprawled face down in the snow. Summer was trying to drive the thing away from him.
What will happen if it kills me?
The boy wondered.
Will I be Hodor, for good or all? Will I go back into summer skin? Or will I just be dead?
The world moved dizzily around him. White trees, black sky, red flames. Everything was whirling, shifting, spinning. He felt himself stumbling. He could hear Hodor screaming,
Hodor! 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 Hodor!
A cloud of ravens was pouring from the cave, and he saw a little girl with a torch in hand, darting this way and that. For a moment, Bran thought of his sister, Arya, madly, for he knew his little sister was 1,000 leagues away, or dead. And yet there she was, whirling, a scrawny thing, ragged, wild, her hair tangled. Tears filled Hodor's eyes, and froze there. Everything turned inside out and upside down, and Bran found himself back inside his own skin, half buried in the snow. The burning white loomed over him, etched tall against the trees in their snowy shrouds. It was one of the naked ones Bran saw in the instant before the nearest tree shook off the snow that covered it and dropped it all down upon his head. The next he knew, he was lying on a bed of pine needles beneath a dark stone roof.
The cave, I'm in the cave.
His mouth still tasted of blood where he'd bitten his tongue. But a fire was burning to his right, the heat washing over his face, and he had never felt anything so good. Summer was there, sniffing round him, and Hodor, soaking wet. Mira cradled Jojen's head in her lap, and the Arya thing stood over them, clutching her torch.
"The snow," Bran said. "It fell on me, buried me. Hid you. I pulled you out."
Mira nodded at the girl.
"It was her who saved us, though. The torch. Fire kills them."
"Fire burns them. Fire is always hungry."
That was not Arya's voice, nor any child's. It was a woman's voice, high and sweet, with a strange music in it like none he had ever heard, and a sadness that he thought might break his heart. Bran squinted to see her better. It was a girl, but littler than Arya, her skin dappled like a doe's beneath a cloak of leaves. Her eyes were queer, large and liquid, gold and green, slitted like a cat's eyes.
"No one has eyes like that."
Her hair was a tangled brown and red and gold, autumn colours with vines and twigs and withered flowers woven through it.
"Who are you?"
Mira Reed was asking. Bran knew.
"She's a child of the forest." He shivered, as much from wonderment as cold. They had fallen into one of old Nan's tales.
"The first men named us children," the little woman said. "The giants called us Wodach Nagran, the squirrel people, because we were small and quick and fond of trees. But we are no squirrels, no children. Our name in the true tongue means those who sing the song of earth. Before your old tongue was ever spoken, we had sung our songs 10,000 years.
Mira said, "You speak the common tongue now."
"For him, the Bran boy, I was born in the time of the dragon, and for 200 years I walked the world of men, to watch and listen and learn. I might be walking still, but my legs were sore, and my heart was weary, so I turned my feet for home."
200 years, said Mira.
The child smiled.
"Men, they are the children."
"Do you have a name?" asked Bran.
"When I am needing one," she waved her torch toward the black crack in the back wall of the cave, "our way is down. You must come with me now."
Bran shivered again.
"The ranger, he cannot come." They'll kill him. No, they killed him long ago. Come now, it is warmer down deep, and no one will hurt you there. He is waiting for you. The three-eyed crow, asked Mira. The green seer. And with that she was off, and they had no choice but to follow. Mira helped Bran back up onto Hodor's back, though his basket was half crushed and wet from melting snow. Then she slipped an arm around her brother and shouldered him back onto his feet once more. His eyes opened.
What? He said. Mira, where are we?
When he saw the fire, he smiled.
I had the strangest dream.
The way was cramped and twisty, and so low that Hodor soon was crouching. Bran hunched down as best he could, but even so the top of his head was soon scraping and bumping against the ceiling. Loose dirt crumbled at each touch and dribbled down into his eyes and hair, and once he smacked his brow on a thick white root growing from the tunnel wall, with tendrils hanging from it and spider webs between its fingers. The child went in front with the torch in hand, her cloak of leaves whispering behind her, but the passage turned so much that Bran soon lost sight of her. Then the only light was what was reflected off the passage walls. After they had gone down a little way, the cave divided, but one branch was dark as pitch, so even Hodor knew to follow the moving torch to the right. The way the shadows shifted made it seem as if the walls were moving too. Bran saw great white snakes slithering in and out of the earth around him, and his heart thumped in fear. He wondered if they had blundered into a nest of milk snakes or giant grave worms, soft and pale and squishy.
Grave worms have teeth.
Hodor saw them too.
Hodor,
he whimpered, reluctant to go on. But when the girl child stopped to let them catch her, the torchlight steadied, and Bran realized that the snakes were only white roots, like the one he'd hit his head on.
It's weirwood roots, he said. Remember the art tree in the God's Wood, Hodor? The white tree with the red leaves? A tree can't hurt you.
Hodor.
Hodor plunged ahead, hurrying after the child and her torch deeper into the earth. They passed another branching and another, then came into an echoing cavern as large as the great hall of Winterfell, with stone teeth hanging from its ceiling and more poking up through its floor. The child in the leafy cloak wound a path through them. From time to time she stopped and waved her torch at them impatiently. This way, it seemed to say. This way, faster. There were more side passages after that. More chambers, and Bran heard dripping water somewhere to his right. When he looked off that way, he saw eyes looking back at them, slitted eyes that glowed bright, reflecting back the torchlight.
More children, he told himself. The girl is not the only one.
But Onan's tale of Gendel's children came back to him as well. The roots were everywhere, twisting through earth and stone, closing off some passages and holding up the roofs of others.
All the colour is gone,
Bran realized suddenly. The world was black soil and white wood. The heart tree at Winterfell had roots as thick around as the giant's legs, but these were even thicker, and Bran had never seen so many of them.
There must be a whole grove of weirwoods growing up above us.
The light dwindled again. Small as she was, the child, who was not a child, moved quickly when she wanted. As Hodor thumped after her, something crunched beneath his feet. His halt was so sudden that Mira and Jojen almost slammed into his back.
"Bones," said Bran. "It's bones."
The floor of the passage was littered with the bones of birds and beasts. But there were other bones as well, big ones that must have come from giants, and small ones that could have been from children. On either side of them, in niches carved from the stone, skulls looked down on them. Bran saw a bear skull and a wolf skull, half a dozen human skulls, and nearly as many giants. All the rest were small, queerly formed.
Children of the forest,
The roots had grown in and around and through them, every one. A few had ravens perched atop them, watching them pass with bright black eyes. The last part of their dark journey was the steepest. Hodor made the final descent on his ass, bumping and sliding downward in a clatter of broken bones, loose dirt, and pebbles. The girl child was waiting for them, standing on one end of a natural bridge above a yawning chasm. Bran heard the sound of rushing water down below in the darkness.
An underground river.
"Do we have to cross?" Bran asked, as the reeds came sliding down behind him. The prospect frightened him. If Hodor slipped on that narrow bridge, they would fall and fall.
"No, boy," the child said. "Behind you."
She lifted a torch higher, and the light seemed to shift and change. One moment the flames burned orange and yellow, filling the cavern with a ruddy glow. Then all the colors faded, leaving only black and white. Behind them, Mira gasped. Hodor turned. Before them, a pale lord in ebon finery sat dreaming in a tangled nest of roots, a woven weirwood throne that embraced his withered limbs as a mother does a child. His body was so skeletal, and his clothes so rotted, that at first Bran took him for another corpse, a dead man propped up so long that the roots had grown over him, under him, and through him. What skin the corpse lord showed was white, save for a bloody blotch that crept up his neck onto his cheek. His white hair was fine and thin as root hair and long enough to brush against the earthen floor. Roots coiled around his legs like wooden serpents. One burrowed through his breeches into the desiccated flesh of his thigh, to emerge again from his shoulder. A spray of dark red leaves sprouted from his skull, and grey mushrooms spotted his brow. A little skin remained, stretched across his face, tight and hard as white leather. But even that was fraying, and here and there the brown and yellow bone beneath was poking through.
"Are you the three-eyed crow?"
Bran heard himself say.
"A three-eyed crow should have three eyes. He has only one, and that one red."
Bran could feel the eyes staring at him, shining like a pool of blood in the torchlight. Where his other eye should have been, a thin white root grew from an empty socket down his cheek and into his neck.
"A crow?"
The pale lord's voice was dry. His lips moved slowly, as if they had forgotten how to form words.
"Once I, black of garb and black of blood."
The clothes he wore were rotten and faded, spotted with moss and eaten through with worms. But once they had been black.
"I have been many things, Bran. Now I am as you see me, and now you will understand why her could not come to you, except in dreams. I have watched you for a long time, watched you with a thousand eyes and one. I saw your birth and that of your lord father before you. I saw your first step, heard your first word, was part of your first dream. I was watching when you fell, and now you are come to me at last, Brandon Stark. Though the hour is late."
"I'm here," Bran said, "only I'm broken. Will you fix me? My legs, I mean."
"No,"
said the pale lord,
"that is beyond my powers."
Bran's eyes filled with tears.
"We came such a long way."
The chamber echoed to the sound of the Black River.
"You will never walk again, Bran,"
the pale lips promised.
"But you will fly."
Tyrion. For a long while he did not stir, but lay unmoving upon the heap of old sacks that served him for a bed, listening to the wind in the lines, to the lapping of the river at the hull.
A full moon floated above the mast. It is following me down river, watching me like some great eye. Despite the warmth of the musty skins that covered him, a shiver went through the little man. I need a cup of wine, a dozen cups of wine. But the moon would blink before that horse and griff let him quench his thirst. Instead, he drank water and was condemned to sleepless nights and days of sweats and shakes. The dwarf sat up, cradling his head in his hands. Did I dream? All memory of it had fled. The nights had never been kind to Tyrion Lannister. He slept badly, even on soft feather beds. On the Shy Maid, he made his bed atop the roof of the cabin, with a coil of hempen rope for a pillow. He liked it better up here than in the boat's cramped hold. The air was fresher, and the river sounds were sweeter than dock snoring. There was a price to be paid for such joys, though. The deck was hard, and he woke stiff and sore, his legs cramped and aching. They were throbbing now, his calves gone hard as wood. He kneaded them with his fingers, trying to rub the ache away, but when he stood, the pain was still enough to make him grimace. I need to bathe. His boy's clothes stank, and so did he. The others bathed in the river, but thus far he had not joined them. Some of the turtles he'd seen in the shallows looked big enough to bite him in half. Bone snappers, Duck called them. Besides, he didn't want the moor to see him naked. A wooden ladder led down from the cabin roof. Tyrion pulled on his boots and descended to the afterdeck, where Griff sat wrapped in a wolf-skin cloak beside an iron brazier. The sellsword kept the night watch by himself, rising as the rest of his band sought their beds, and retiring when the sun came up. Tyrion squatted down across from him and warmed his hands over the coals. Across the water, nightingales were singing. "Day soon," he said to Griff. "Not soon enough. We need to be under way." If it had been up to Griff, the Shy Maid would continue downstream by night as well as day. But Yandri and Ysilla refused to risk their pole boat in the dark. The upper ruin was full of snags and sawyers, any one of which could rip out the Shy Maid's hull. Griff did not want to hear it. What he wanted was Valantis. The sellsword's eyes were always moving, searching the night for what? Pirates, stone men, slave catchers? The river had perils, the dwarf knew, but Griff himself struck Tyrion as more dangerous than any of them. He reminded Tyrion of Bronn, though Bronn had a sellsword's black humour, and Griff had no humour at all. "Oh, I would kill for a cup of wine," muttered Tyrion. Griff made no reply. "You will die before you drink," his pale eyes seemed to say. Tyrion had drunk himself blind his first night on the Shy Maid. The next day he awoke with dragons fighting in his skull. Griff took one look at him retching over the side of the pole boat and said, "You are done with drink." "Wine helps me sleep," Tyrion had protested. "Wine drowns my dreams," he might have said. "Then stay awake," Griff had replied, implacable. To the east, the first pale light of day suffused the sky above the river. The waters of the Roine slowly went from black to blue to match the sellsword's hair and beard. Griff got to his feet. "The others should wake soon. The deck is yours." As the nightingales fell silent, the river larks took up their song. Egrets splashed amongst the reeds and left their tracks across the sandbars. The clouds in the sky were aglow, pink and purple, maroon and gold, pearl and saffron. One looked like a dragon. Once a man has seen a dragon in flight, let him stay at home and tend his garden in content, someone had written once, for this wide world has no greater wonder. Tyrion scratched his scar and tried to recall the author's name. Dragons had been much in his thoughts of late. "Good morrow, Hugo."
Septa Lamore had emerged in her white robes, cinched at the waist with a woven belt of seven colours.